Welcome.
Hey folks, it's Taking It Down. You know that. You know where you are. You're with us. And we appreciate you tuning in. We are an Alabama Take podcast. And in fact, until the original Alabama Take comes back from hiatus, we're still coming at you once a week, every Tuesday. Subscribe to us. You can join in on the discussion online. And we'll talk about what we've been watching and doing and our thoughts on those kinds of things. If you're new to the show, welcome. Thanks for joining us. Joining me today is, as always, is co-host Adam Morrow. And we have a special guest for this first segment coming up. We're going to be talking to our old friend Donovan Reinwald. He has been a guest on a few of our podcast episodes, so we'll welcome him back. Let's not wait. We'll go ahead and get into today's episode.
Hello.
Welcome, Donovan. There he is.
Donovan. Yes.
So, Donovan, we brought you here to tell you that John Prine died.
When did this happen?
That's honestly a good question. So we're going to reflect on John Prine and his music, but I think he died last Thursday. Correct me, Adam.
I don't know what day today is. So
exactly.
I'm
literally just hearing about this. I'm processing a lot of emotions, and I'm not physically able to Google this for you.
I feel like it was Thursday.
I think so. And
it's been several decades, basically.
Yeah.
So Prine would appreciate that joke, I bet, because he had a way with words and talking about he had this thing that I may be jumping the gun here, but he had this thing that he would do where he would take what you expected and play with that, I think, in words. Yeah, we'll get into some of those things. So John Prine, of course, passed away from coronavirus complications, from what I understand. I think around Thursday, that's what we're thinking. We're coming at you on Tuesday. And what we're going to do is just talk about his music and him, the man himself, as much as we can. Yeah, let's start with Adam. How big of a John Prine fan were you? And tell me why you were or weren't.
I think I didn't come to his music until really probably about the time that I started playing with you, Blaine. Definitely the first time that I heard Lake Marie was you doing it at an acoustic night at the Bama Theater. Many, many moons ago, especially starting to do music full time, it was kind of inevitable that you were going to be around it. And I tended to let his stuff come to me as it would, because it had a habit of that. If that makes, you know, those artists that I'm not going to seek out their entire discography after the hook is set, because, I mean, just that first record alone. There's enough to chew on there for a good long spell. But yeah, and especially with, we kind of intersected paths a few times. I was very peripherally for me, but, you know, playing with Donnie Fritz, they were big buds, big time buds, wrote songs together. Donnie would always talk about him. They would go see each other in the hospital, all this. I mean, neither of them were very healthy men for the last 15 or 20 years of their lives. So I think hospital visits were, they got a kick out of that. But yeah, just circling around both his work and his personality in those kind of indirect ways. And he's just he's a legend. I mean, he was a legend years ago, and he certainly is now.
Before we move into Donovan's thoughts on Prine and his music, Adam, did you ever meet him?
So I was around him twice, and they're both pretty good. I always hate, if you've listened to the show before, I hate doing this, but
I want you to, and I think our listeners want you to. We want to hear, because let's be honest, even with the three of us, I don't know that we could conjure the correct amount of description to fit John Prine and his music. I'm a huge fan, and still am. And a lot of people are. A lot of people in the circles that we run with, and a lot of our friends are. So yeah, I definitely want to hear both of these stories, and then that might even prep Donovan to gather his emotions.
Sure. Well, and I'll say to follow up on, am I a fan? Yeah, I'm a huge fan. And since that early kind of trickle, I have really dove in, done a deep dive, whatever my verb tense there is. I guess the first time that I was around him, if I really want to tell the name droppy story, we were at Newport Folk Festival. Donovan was there for this. It was one of the only times that we were up Donovan's way these days. And so I said, hey, do you want to come to Newport? And he said, yeah, yeah, I'll do that. So
yeah. Yes.
Newport, just as magical as you would expect. Probably the best festival that I've ever been to or been a part of. But they were doing these old tintype pictures. And if you're not familiar with the idea of Newport, they do it at a old military fort. So different parts of the fort are concert stages. The big one is just outside the walls of the fort, and it faces that bay, harbor, or whatever the official geographical name of that body of water would be. But so this guy was there doing these tintype pictures, kind of like you think of like Civil War. They shine a really bright light and you have to stand very still. And they said, any band that wants to do one, come on through, schedule a time. So we had scheduled to go in at like 6 o'clock. We go in and there's a big crowd, and this like photographer's assistant comes over, and we're kind of just trying to figure out what's going on. And this is in like a small little room, right? If you've ever been to, if you're an Alabamian and you've been to Fort Gaines or Fort Morgan, think about one of those little side room kind of things. So she says, can y'all come back in like 10 minutes? And we're like, yeah, that's fine. And the girl I was with, the fiddle player for John, she's talking to this woman, and I'm looking, and Roger Waters is in the back having his picture taken like 10 feet away. And I mean, that's like, we're in rarefied air now. So I'm like, yeah, of course I'll stand outside and try to not embarrass myself. But yeah, so he does his picture, and you familiar with the band Lucius, the two girls, they put out some great records.
Honestly, no.
Donovan, I know you're a,
yeah.
Yeah. So they were on tour with Roger Waters at that time, singing background vocals, like doing the Great Gig in the Sky thing and all that. So they were all in there getting their picture made. And then they come out and I, you know, get to pass Roger. That was very cool. But I say all that to say, this is leading to the John Prine. Roger Waters had on tour intentionally taken a day off because he knew that Prine was going to be at Newport, flown halfway across the country to come watch his set and play one song with him.
Wow.
You don't think of Pink Floyd and John Prine really in the same sphere, but I think that it speaks to how universally loved he was and respected at this craft, at this thing, because he would do a thing to me. A lot of people, especially in the Americana world, want to talk about songwriting craft, and that kind of makes me want to blow my brains out, but he's the only one that... like you see what, or one of the only ones that you really see what he means. Like there's a skill being mm-hmm. flexed, but it's also so human and still so artful. But at the end of that day, that was Sunday of Newport, and the last night or the last show, it all ends about sunset. So at sunset, I'm watching John Prine play. They play Lake Marie, and that I was standing on the side of the stage, and the stage was like rolling. It was grooving so hard. He didn't get enough credit for how good that band could be live. I think people think of him as the guy with the acoustic guitar and the songs, but I mean they were filling up the sky with some music. It was incredible. But then that last song, they played Paradise, and they invited all the bands to come on stage and sing it with them. So technically I have collaborated with Mr. John Prine, though I don't know I would ever claim that outside of talking to my two buddies here and whoever else is listening. I did with John Paul this Kayamo cruise thing where it's like a bunch of Americana bands on a boat.
Just to be clear for our listeners, especially if you're a new listener, Adam is great at thoughtful analysis on television, but he tours as a guitar player for John Paul Wyatt and has toured with as a guitar player for Lee Banks III and the Glory Fires. He has his own band. He's never going to mention this stuff. Adam's way too humble to mention this. So he has his own band called Speckled Bird. You can find online. They're going to produce some music soon and some music already produced out there with Della Ray. Go find these bands.
It's so good.
Yeah, and it is. It really is. It's good. And I was talking to Adam last night about how how I enjoy his stuff and how I think it's just getting even better. Adam's never going to say this, and so that's why I'm doing it now. But no, give us that second.
There's some good stuff there.
Absolutely. Give us that second John Prine encounter.
Well, so we went and did this cruise, which is a very foreign idea to me. I would never, I don't think, be the first, definitely not the first person to sign up to be on a cruise. I don't know about y'all, but even pre-COVID in our lives, you just think of them as like, oh man, it's a bunch of strangers in confined space. That, you know, that just seems weird. But we went
love on that Hitchcock movie, Strangers in a Pool.
Exactly. So that's exactly what. But then, and the pool is moving the whole time because the boat's rocking, and you just see it's like there's no way that that pee is just settling beside that guy. It's sloshing around. It's not great. But so we went on this cruise, which was it was a lot of fun. They're very well done. It's this company that does music cruises, so they're very, very professional and very good at it. Me and old Todd Bean shared a room with an ocean view. It was just a lovely time. But John Prine was the headliner, and the way that it was him and Brandi Carlile was the other, I guess, big star. I mean, there were a lot. Margot Price was on the boat. There were a lot of big stars, not to mention anybody else. But it is a heavy hitters cruise, and there's like a waiting list to be someone who attends it, because, you know, if you're on this boat, you're going to see these people in the hallway and like have to act respectfully and not drive them crazy. And they were all very good about that. Anyway, the first night started off, we left from New Orleans and we're going to go out into the Gulf. And if you cruise out of New Orleans, you're on the Mississippi River for a long time. You know, you got to snake through all those bayous before you finally get out to sea. So that is the backdrop for a John Prine tribute from other bands and artists on the boat. And I looked up while Aaron Lee Tashjian was playing Lake Marie. Again, Lake Marie seems like the common thread here, but he was doing a great job. And I looked up, and the nice cabins, the suites, had like, they were at the very top of the boat and could overlook this main area. And up there on the balcony alone, Prine was just sitting there watching. And nobody had noticed him. I realized I was the only one that had seen him up there. I was kind of looking around. And unfortunately, I kind of gave him away because I was watching him and other people around me. Started taking pictures of him up there and stuff. You know, just that image of this guy watching this boat full of a genre he kind of helped create, enjoy his music, cruising down a river. That was very cool. That same trip, John Paul got to play with him, and I got a few stories about what that was like. And John does a beautiful version of Sam Stone that he can pull out at the drop of a hat. And it's one of his more stunning covers to me. But yeah, I mean, that whole, I don't know how to sum all that up. All the interactions around him have had kind of been tinged with a little bit of magic, I guess, for me, between Donnie and that Newport experience and the boat. And then hearing, you know, John Paul ended up getting to tour with him a bit as his opening act. And just talking about what a gracious, down-to-earth guy he is, and that humor that's in the songs. He said, I don't know how hard he's trying, because even if he's just joking around with you backstage, that's it. All those quick turns of phrases, he'll do it in conversation. So he was just cut from a different cloth. I mean, so somebody pointed out that when he went up to play his first open mic night, you know, he already had Angel from Montgomery and Hello in there and all these songs done, and he wasn't even 24 years old yet. Crazy.
Exactly. It's got to come natural. With a guy like John Prine, when you hear his songs, you think that. You think, this is just natural for this guy. Donovan, tell me about your relationship with John Prine's music.
So, Adam kind of mentioned this, but the first time I ever heard a John Prine song was at an acoustic night at the Bama Theater when you played Lake Marie. And I was just like bowled away by that song. I think it must have been, that had to have been like 2009, 2010, something like that.
I think it was, 2010 or 2011.
Yeah, it was something like that. And I just, that was just a song that like I didn't even listen to other stuff for like a week of his, because I just couldn't believe how how I, there was just something in that, like that song, Lake Marie, my favorite John Prine song.
Okay, yeah.
Because it's just, there was something like magical in that. And that song is still like a, like, you know, like that spring day when like it first gets really nice again and you can roll down the windows in your car and you just want to play something and you're, you know, you want to play something that feels as big as your heart feels, right? When you're going and things are getting green, and that's that song for me. And I think he was such, you know, he was such, it's the writing, and this cuts now goes to kind of all of his songs. You know, it's the writing and it's the way that he could, you know, it's the way that he was clever, but not only that, it's almost like the way like he could be, like some people are just clever and that's it, you know?
Yeah.
But it's the way, like there's a line in Lake Marie that I look, cause it makes you laugh, but it's sad. Mm-hmm. Where he says, me and a couple years later, we were up there trying to save our marriage, maybe catch a few fish, whichever one came easier. And it's just like, it's so like true. Like maybe the best thing about the way he made you laugh was he'd make you laugh in recognition. Like, oh yeah, no, I know that. I've been there, you know?
He was also, if he was funny, it was never, I think maybe Jason Isbell said this in the last few days, it was never at the expense of anyone else.
Yeah.
He, you know, the humor didn't rely on putting anybody else down. It just was clever and funny and insightful. One moment that I'll share that really bowled me over, he was playing stuff on that cruise. They have like a little theater, so I went to see him play. He was playing stuff off of what ended up being his last record. And he said, this is a new song. And he played Summer's End. And frankly, I'd been on tour with Belladair for like a month before I got on that boat. And there's no cell phone service on the boat. And I hadn't talked to my wife in a long time and was just missing people. And that was just pretty crushing to sit like alone in this crowd in this balcony and, you know, just hear this dude who is north of 70 and still riding at that level that just destroyed me.
I tell you, what's kind of amazing about that last record is like a song that I listen to over. Actually, I've got two. I mean, they're all good, but I've got two real favorites in that. It's No Ordinary Blue. And like that song just bowls me over every time. And it like, this dude's like from record one to the last record. Like there's a song that just knocks you out. Who can do that?
There are only a few. When Adam Morrow, our co-host here, when he texted me the news, or we were conversing about the news via text, I think I said, you know, that Prine was one of the absolute greats. You know, you say that about artists, you say, oh, they were one of the greats and that one, they were a good one, but Prine's in the top three, two, you know, if somebody said he's my top one, I wouldn't blink.
No, not at all.
Isn't it funny, almost like, I almost feel like once he died, like I started finding out like people I knew or just like people I follow on Twitter or whatever, like loved him so much. It was almost like he was so good. You just like, you almost took him for granted. I certainly did. Mm-hmm. I almost took him for granted, if that makes sense. And it's almost like it took him dying for people to be like, he meant so much. His music meant so much. And well, all of these, every song that he wrote, like everybody had some different song that meant or intersected at some different point in their life. And I think that's kind of incredible too. But not everyone's just sharing the same song.
So you guys have both mentioned Lake Marie, and that may be one of my favorite. I think it is my favorite John Prine song, but just to give our listeners something to seek out if they want to kind of relish in John Prine's beauty and amazement. The version I do of, or I used to do of Lake Marie was a version he did alone. Normally when you see Prine or you hear his live versions or his record, there's a band or a backing guitarist and bass player or something like that. But I was doing a version of Lake Marie that I'd seen him do on this odd little Elvis Costello show called Spectacle. I think it was on one of those kind of oddball channels as well. And Brian did it by himself. And on that show was also Lyle Lovett and Elvis Costello and Ray, help me with his last name, Ray LaMontagne.
Yeah.
Yeah, so they were all, and then they did a version of Townes Van Zandt's Loretta together. But the version, you can find it on YouTube. Now, unfortunately, it cuts off at 3/4 of the way through the song for whatever reason. Like you can, but it's still that, so you don't get the climactic moment of the song. The song is a movie, you know, it is a cinematic piece. And I have a shout out to my friend Lindsay Grantline. One time she and I, about 10 years ago, she and I were conversing back and forth on Facebook, and we were dissecting this song through conversation. And I wish I still had that conversation. Maybe I do on Facebook somewhere, but we'd really gotten to how deep this song was in its simplicity. I'm always in love with a simple line that reverberates through several levels, if that makes sense. And I think I first got into Prine about 2002 to 2003, and I want to just give a quick shout out to Raz for turning me on to Prine back then. He said, well, we were listening to Todd Snyder at the time, and he said, well, if you like him, you'd like John Prine. And that's exactly, and then the rocket was launched right there.
Still sailing out through the crystal blue out there, that rocket.
Yeah. For sure. So let's do this. We've mentioned Lake Marie. I imagine we would all agree with that one. Other than that, let's pull. We're kind of still in this season. Let's pull our final four John Prine songs. Okay. Ooh. Final four. Yeah, and we'll
That's
go and take.
Tough.
It's very tough. So we'll pull Lake Marie off of the. You know, that's probably a given. So let's pull that one. Other than Lake Marie, what are your essential? Three or four of John Prine. We could go final four if we wanted. So
I've got a song that it is probably far from essential, but it's
no,
his
let's
song,
hear it.
Saigon.
Really?
Yeah.
Tell me.
I've always liked that one. And then when I was reading about it, I've always liked it. I kind of have liked it because he sounds kind of edgy and kind of angry and kind of. And it kind of rocks. Like if you listen to it, there's a bit where he breaks a piece of equipment while he's recording it, because he was playing his guitar too loud. He blows it. You can kind of hear a little pop in the background. I think it's an amp or something going out, which is kind of cool because like you kind of have this idea of like he's kind of a scoundrel. He's kind of a scrapper, but he's kind of a gentle dude too, right?
Mm-hmm.
And he just that is a. It's almost it's I think the kind of his classic one is right. Your American flag won't get you in, decal won't get you into heaven anymore. But
yeah,
I think
good choice.
Saigon sounds scrappier and rockier. So I'll, yeah. That's going to be my number two.
There you go, Adam. Give us one.
It's tough for me. It's tough for me to get in terms of like essential listening, and maybe it's because of how I came to him, but. The first record holds most of the things that, like, if I was going to hand somebody the songbook and say, like, here, start here. I mean, it's stuff like Sam Stone, you know, yeah. Or Hello in There. Mm-hmm. I don't know. That's so tough. I mean,
6 o'clock news.
Yeah. I mean, it's so dense. I mean, how do you.
Well, here's what I think. This is, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, but I think that first album is such. It's dense, first and foremost, but I think second of all, it's not as overproduced as his latter records are.
Yeah.
And he isn't as, luckily for Prine, his records aren't as guilty of this as Townes Van Zandt was. But the studio stuff is often, for Prine, a little overproduced. Nothing nothing horrible. You can still absolutely get through a record and love it and just continue to play it. But if you really want the Prine experience, you would have had to have seen him live or get, I think he's got about 3 or 4 live albums, which are wonderful. So
yeah,
I think that first album does not suffer from any overproduction.
Yeah. And it was kind of made in the sweet spot of eras for making records like that. Whereas maybe as time went on, those same players and producers got a little indulgent with their sound and maybe their chemicals
and a little coked up. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Didn't do him any favors. That's what I thought his last record was maybe, pulled back some of the overproduction in a nice way.
Yeah, it's perfect. That last,
there's so much good. Yeah, it feels very, heck, it almost kind of matches the cover, right? Because it's got that kind of black background. Mm-hmm. And it really puts his voice more in the center, which is where it always should have been. But that record really puts his voice in the center. And it's like your best friend. It's like your dad's best friend came over to tell you jokes.
It is a grandpa or an uncle. Yeah. I'm going to throw out Wedding Day and Funeralville, which I think is the epitome of his wordplay, his gentle and not forced wordplay. I was always a big fan of Grandpa Was a Carpenter, which was just an autobiographical song from him, and does in 3 minutes what some writers can't do in a lifetime. And I'll throw out Picture Show or Far From Me. Those would kind of be tied. So those are some of what I would think would be a central or a final four. And I say this, and maybe we can start the descent on celebrating Prine, but I think there's something about John Prine's music that that does well. It doesn't lose a lot in covers. Why do you guys think that? You both agree. So why is that? What about a John Prine song that almost anybody can do and won't ruin? Or you don't just cringe or anything, usually, if the musician's, adept enough?
I think most of the time it's the instrumentation, or at least the chord structure, is pretty simple. And his vocal, I heard him joke about one of his surgeries that was going to be near a vocal cord. They said, "Well, we may mess up your singing voice." And he said, "Have you heard me sing?" he wasn't too worried about it. So you don't have to be the best singer in the world, though I think his voice was perfect for what he did.
Yeah.
But it's also, if you're going to cover one of his songs, you've already kind of like made a certain cut of, like, you're probably not going to cover it if you don't have a little bit of taste going on already. And you're also going to be forced to, or at least you understand that the words are probably the most important thing going on, and to not screw with those too much. Don't screw with the, you've really got to keep it on the tracks, so to speak. And then the chords are simple enough that you can't make too much of a mess out of it.
Yeah, I'll basically second everything Adam said. I think it's the simplicity of the songs, and also, I mean, you could probably say this for every cover, but I think at least the covers I've heard of John Prine, it's folks doing it because they really love it. Like, they really love John Prine.
Yeah.
And they want to do right by the song. It's not like somebody's doing this for a commercial.
Right.
Or whatever.
Have you guys ever heard Swamp Dog's version of Sam Stone?
No.
No, I saw that you put this on the show notes, and I am fascinated to hear this now.
It's very good. It's I'm not gonna say it's better than the original, but he takes it a step away from that arrangement a little. Anyway, Swamp Dog adds some funk, I suppose you could say.
Oh, I guess so. Yeah.
Well, yeah, that may be a simplistic way of explaining it, but if you haven't heard it, I suggest it. It is one of my favorite Prine covers, and I'll also give a quick shout out to Justin Townes Earl's version of "Far From Me." It's really good.
Oh, I've heard that one.
It is good, right?
What the heck am I? Maybe I'm thinking of a cover of "Angel from Montgomery." I do not know what I'm thinking.
And that's the most widely covered one.
Yeah, maybe I'm thinking of that one. I think this is a total like side note, but it feels like kind of like contemporary country women singers have really done a lot of good, or had a lot of success with "Angel from Montgomery," which is neither here nor there, but just kind of interesting.
Starting with Bonnie Raitt, probably.
Yeah, right, that one's good.
Yeah. So any final thoughts on John Prine, or anything you think our listeners would want to know?
I tell you what, he's obviously a Southern artist, which I appreciate. And I think his the bit in "Christmas in Prison," the chorus there is about as close to a secular altar call as you can get. Or maybe it really is an altar call.
Mm-hmm.
Come to me, run to me, come to me now. Mm-hmm. So I think there's some
interesting that you say Southern, because to me he feels still rooted in that Midwestern kind of way of relating to other people, way of not taking yourself too seriously. I mean, I feel like even though it may not be an obvious thing, like your Jeff Tweedies of the world have some, in the way that they carry themselves, some relation to him. We actually, I was just thinking about this, it just hit me. On tour last year, we drove through Central City, Kentucky, which is in Muhlenberg County. Also, oddly, home of the, we stopped because one, we, it kind of clicked like, oh, this is where that is. And we turned off the interstate and went to the Everly Brothers Museum that's there. There's a few notable folks from that area. Wow. But Brian had just played last July, July 13th. I have the set list pulled up here. 2019. He played a little amphitheater in Central City, Kentucky, which was as close to the seat of paradise as you could get. And I think that's pretty neat that he did that less than a year before he left us.
I think that works well as a metaphor too, that Prine is a perfect blend of the beautiful things of Midwestern people and Southern people.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yep. Yeah.
All right, guys. Donovan, we want to thank you for joining us, man. It's been a little bit.
I know. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, man, we love it. And we'll get you back on maybe again sometime soon.
Enjoy that.
Sitting around the house.
Yeah, I think we're all kind of sitting around. So here's what we'll do. We will take a break. And when we come back, Adam and I are going to talk some television. We're going to talk Unorthodox on Netflix. We're going to talk about Dev's most recent episode on Hulu. And we're going to talk a little I Am Not Okay With This and a little bit of challenge related stuff going on. So yeah, a lot more to come. Stick with us. Let's take a break. Folks, Taking It Down is part of the Alabama Take Network of podcasts, all of which you can find on the website, thealabamatake.com, or subscribe to us. You just have to find each podcast individually, and you should be good to go. Visit us. Visit us on the website. We have lots of content on the Alabama Take, and pretty soon, Corey Hanna will return with the podcast that started it all, where he sits with artists near and far, authors, all sorts of talented people. And that's called the Alabama Take, of course. So join us, and we hope to hear from you soon. Okay, we're back. Adam and I are going to talk a few television shows, rapid fire maybe, a little. But before we do, you know, in the break I was talking about how we appreciate our listeners, and we really do. I want to just say a special hello to whoever comments on our website as 87 Jetta, whoever you are, just thanks for listening. You have whoever you are, you have a tendency to come in and say hello after we've posted something or make a little a discussion type of comment, and that's awesome. Thanks.
And great name.
Yeah, and if I'm not mistaken,
great handle. Yeah,
if I'm not mistaken, that is a Dexateens reference. Isn't that a Dexateens song?
You would know.
Well, it's from that, I think they have a song called 87 Jetta on that really punk album that they recorded before their first album.
You are the one that I would ask this question to. So if you don't know, I don't know.
I don't know. If you're a member of the Dexateens, that's even more awesome because I know who you are. Just stop by again and say, hey. All right. So you and I are going to talk first and foremost about Netflix show Unorthodox. Which I think, how far are you now with Unorthodox?
Did
you
end up finishing it? Yeah, we finished it last week after we recorded.
So I'm halfway through. I'm where you were initially when we first brought it up. Just for starters, quick, you summarized it pretty well. All you really need to know going in, I think, is what I knew, which was Unorthodox is about a really orthodox version of Judaism. In a way, but it's specifically about this young girl who is in Williamsburg, Brooklyn, and she decides to get out. And like you told me last week, that happens in the first 5 minutes. She doesn't want any more of the marriage and religion she's involved with.
That's it. Yeah. And then they spend the rest of the episodes filling in some of the backstory, but yeah, that inciting action is just right out of the gate.
I feel as though I should tread kind of lightly because I don't want to be offensive with some of my ignorance, but the show does enlighten you on a few of their customs and rituals of that Hasidic Judaism, that particular version of that type of Judaism.
Yeah, and it was interesting to me. You know, we talked about the Eruv last week, the wire around their community that exists in these cities. But, you know, if you go to a major city, if you're in New York, you see these folks walking around, and you definitely have an understanding that these are Jewish folks who are very, very serious about their religion. And I know that all religions have different factions that kind of splinter off and have their own ancient traditions. And so I always wondered, you know, as I walk past these people and say New York or wherever, you know, what the fascination for me is living. It would be the same as anybody who's like a monk or a nun in New York City. Like what is that life like? You know, because you're in, especially in the case of this Hasidic culture as portrayed by Unorthodox, kind of a very closed off world in the middle of these very vibrant cities, and like what that tension is like, what life would be like in that. And this show is pretty fascinating on that front for me.
It really is. This show takes you into a brand new world, or brand new for me. And you can kind of hear us tiptoeing as white male, you know, guys.
Who, yeah. Yeah.
Which I hope our listeners are a little understanding if we get something wrong, because some of my knowledge comes from the show, and other parts of my knowledge are non-existent. So I don't guess you'd call it knowledge, but
I definitely have the Wikipedia app open and running while watching the show, just to try to get context for things. And I appreciate that they don't over explain anything, because I think it's meant to be a human story, and you could miss the vocabulary words, I guess, on a lot of it and still get something from it. You know, like it's that the setting, it's definitely what drives the action, but it's really a coming of age story in a particular set of circumstances.
It is. I think you can read it that way. And to me, it's as much about the dangers of traditions. And it reminds me of Shirley Jackson's The Lottery in a way, that how you can be so trapped by your ritual or your tradition, and that becomes your surroundings, and you just can't see beyond the repetition of what you're doing. When I say you there, I mean the society that's perpetuating these things.
Yeah. And I think that can exist in really any religion, or outside of that, any world that you create that is an intense community like that, certainly in the evangelical world. Or, you know, you see, to take it to the extreme, the problems that Catholicism is having right now for covering up for priests for various abuses, all these kinds of things. But in this one, it really comes out, you know, Esther is told several times, and her husband, her young husband as well, you have no idea what the outside world is like, or how difficult it is, or how ill prepared they are. You know, she immediately runs into the fact that she hasn't really had what we would think of as a proper education. She has no discernible skills that can lead to employment, really. It's a world built up to support people, but also to clip their wings in a way, because you're safe as long as you stay in that world. But as soon as you try to leave, I mean, I'm trying to not mix episodes here and spoil anything for you, but you know, she sits down at a computer and is kind of just staring at it. Like, I don't know how to work a search engine, you know, like, how does this work? That kind of thing.
I think the wings that are clipped in particular are the wings of the females in this. And, you know, at the risk of stepping on some toes, first of all, I'm not very religious at all. Second of all, at the risk of stepping on some toes here, this particular brand of Judaism seems to me incredibly sexist and patriarchal and superstitious. So it seems very dangerous, which makes Esther, our protagonist, such a compelling lead character, because I'm pulling for her as much as you would any character.
Yeah, absolutely. I think they do a good, there's a lot of nuance in how they treat her husband. He could have just been, and this is based on a memoir, so I suppose it's not really a character invention so much as someone's actual personality, but he could have been just kind of a monster.
Exactly.
pursuing her, but instead he is just as trapped and stunted by all of this as she is. And there's the cousin character, that Moisha, that is a little bit more worldly and maybe sees two young people that he can kind of push around, specifically Yankee, the husband. But they do a good job of the closed-in world of Williamsburg versus the wide-open landscape of Berlin, you know, one of the most vibrant cities in the world. And then Esther is trying to figure it all out. Yankee has no idea what's going on. He's totally lost in it. And Moisha is, he's the devil on his shoulder the whole time kind of character, but also up to his own games.
I think that Moisha, for me, he boils my blood much more so than Yankee does. Her husband, Yankee, is as inept as perhaps Esther is, and maybe just as miserable, though much less willing to acknowledge that. But for me, Moisha raises the stakes and makes me much more pissed off, because he has sort of dropped this orthodox version of Judaism and went out into the world and kind of did his thing. You seem to, it's hinted at that he's partied and he still smokes and he gambles, and he hasn't dropped those things, but yet he comes back into the Judaism and still wants to enforce the sexism and the misogyny, which I just think he's for that, he's much more responsible for driving my hatred, I guess, in this version. Yeah,
he's the bad guy for sure.
He's the bad guy. He's the antagonist, I think. No, and the husband, Yankee, he should know better. Yankee maybe doesn't. And I'm only halfway through it, so I guess I can make this comment. I'm pulling for Yankee as well, as to sort of wake up and go back home and say, this is not what we need to be doing. Maybe not on this level. There are some parts of this religion that will certainly help us and make us spiritual and wonderful people, but there are other things we absolutely have to drop.
Yeah. It's a pretty fascinating glimpse into that world, though. But also told through the eyes of someone who escaped it. So I don't know. It's not to totally sit here and rag on Hasidic Judaism, but you know, there's a reason that she runs away.
Exactly. And okay. Yeah. Anyway, I'm really glad you turned me on to this show. I'm looking forward to finishing it, because it is it's very well done. And one of the things that makes me realize how well done it is how they use actors I've never seen before and still operate on a very high level.
I do think the change in Esther is something that you threw in our notes. That'll maybe the last thing to say about that. She does that really well. That actress plays that transition. You even noted specifically her going into the lake there in Berlin and coming out in this kind of rebirth scene. She does it's very clear when she goes from being afraid to when she goes to being wide-eyed and curious about everything. Yeah.
And that seems to be the moment, which is a very baptismal piece of imagery.
It is.
For me, it is.
It's all taking place I think that idea, that submersion and rebirth, I mean, that is predates Christianity.
Yeah, exactly.
That is involved in a lot of cultures, but especially happening, you know, one of the other students with them points out, well, that's where the Nazis met to begin basically the Holocaust. And, you know, they're in this place that's so haunted by that history, yet here is someone from an ultra conservative Jewish life in America coming here to find freedom in a way.
And that's how that's toward the end of the first episode. Good image to inch closer toward the end of that. And then it's contrasted. It's juxtaposed, I guess you could say, by her having to go in. And one of the rituals apparently is that she has to go into this place and get cleaned up before she can be married or have sex with her husband. I couldn't quite figure.
Some sort of cleansing ceremony, for lack of a better word, just before the wedding, I assume. I don't know if it was it had to do with the wedding night or just the wedding ceremony.
And man, I'll say this, that the expressions and the way that they convey some of these rituals makes it look like absolute torture. to me.
Some of it is tough to watch.
It is. It is. So Unorthodox, it's a great show. It really takes you, if you're like us and, you know, you're listening to the Alabama Take podcast here, or one of the Alabama Take podcasts, we're assuming you might be from around Alabama. It's a totally different world, and that's okay. That's what art can do for you.
Absolutely.
Let's shift gears into devs. I don't have a good segue, but we want to talk about the most recent episode, which is the penultimate episode. They're going to give us the final episode this week, but devs on Hulu.
It's quite a shift. I guess we'll jump right into spoilers, but going from a show about ancient religion and, I guess, the will of God and all these things, you go to human beings who think they might be God.
There you go. There's our segue.
There it is.
This most recent episode of Devs really had you and I asking, what event would we watch if we could pull up actual history as if it was a Roku device?
I told you that watching them kind of play with the Devs machine felt like the first time that I got internet. And like really, I could feel like I can search anything. Like you can just, it's there. How does this work? How does all this information work? But that sense of wonder of a new computer or the internet times, you know, a billion, because now they can search all of human history in high res.
So what events would you go to? Give me a few that you, if you had 10 minutes alone with this machine, what would you watch? And you just knew, you know, how to get that going. You'd go straight to what, 3 or 4 events?
Oh, we kind of went back and forth on this. I mean, you'd want to see someone who grew up in Western culture. You got to go back to Christ at some point, right? You got to see what Jesus was up to.
Exactly. But I think my reasoning for that was much more spiteful than perhaps maybe yours.
You wanted to see if it was, you're looking for truth.
I'm going to give it truth. I wanted to see if he really rose from the dead or if he really died. Maybe he didn't quite die. Yeah.
Yeah. I think it's interesting in the show that that's also one of the first places they go. I mean, just barely before they go to Marilyn Monroe and Arthur Miller having sex. Christ on the cross barely beats that out.
Well, it's a religious moment too.
Yeah. But interesting that they chose that moment of suffering instead of, you wanted to see, yesterday was Easter, you wanted to see if the tomb was empty or not. And I said it would be interesting to see him give the Sermon on the Mount or something like that, this piece of orating that has survived for 2,000 years. That must have been something, you know, at the time. Whatever your opinion is, whatever this guy said endured, if it was recorded in any accurate way, it'd be pretty interesting. I mean,
What if you went back and watched that and he basically was giving the Sermon on the Mount in the same style as Barack Obama?
That would make total sense to me.
So that's really where we went with Devs. How let's get into the episode, maybe a little specifically. We won't belabor the point. We've talked a lot about Devs, but how would you feel about the episode that had Lyndon trying to prove the multiverse by standing on the dam and eventually falling?
Our theory from last week that maybe the person in the vision is Lyndon, that didn't hold up well.
No, it didn't. No. And you've got the reveal that the homeless guy was actually some sort of Russian operative.
That did hold up well.
Right. And then we have the episode ends, of course, with Lily going to Devs and saying, it's almost to the point where I might be interpreting it wrong, so you let me know what you think, where she's like, well, I'm just going to go really mess you guys up. If it's me showing up that throws everything off, then let's do it, because her boyfriend had just been murdered.
Yeah. This episode to me, you know, when you recommend somebody a show that hasn't, which I've been recommending this one far and wide, hasn't concluded yet, you always do it with a little bit of trepidation about, man, I hope they stick the landing. And right. To me, this was the best episode yet. Just in terms of both the action, how it followed up on the one before it. You know, last week was kind of the episode 6 was the calm before the storm, if you will. And then immediate action this time, you know, the body count is fairly high within the first few minutes. And they're, but still maintaining the philosophical questioning that they keep hinting around, I guess. You know, like the multiverse idea is tested with Lyndon very early on. And they even, Nick Offerman presents that encounter in a kind of a funny way. He says, remember, Lyndon's going to be in your car.
Mm-hmm. When she deal leaves, with that.
Deal with that. And so I guess my question now with Lyndon is, do you think that she or he fell or do you think he was pushed?
Yeah, because it's never shown.
No, it stays a mystery.
I wondered that too. But I think, and that's a good question. So I don't have an answer to it. And I did question that in the moment, but it didn't linger with me as much as this. So if Lyndon falls every single time, that doesn't really kill the multiverse theory. There's this possibility that if this thing exists, there are some events that are just going to happen every single time.
Right. Which is, I guess, is the test, right? Interesting that this episode, you know, multiple episodes have opened with things that haven't happened yet and are later revealed to be happening. Say, Kenton in the fight with the original Russian operative in that parking garage.
Right.
This one, there's a shot of Lyndon sitting at the bottom of that dam in the opening, mixed in with that, the people in the caves.
The opening also has that strange and somewhat disturbing kind of repetitive. It sounds like it came from a blues song mixed in with a piece of newer music. Did you find out anything more about that?
I did. That's how the episode ended too, right? Didn't that play over the credits? Yeah.
Yeah, something about letting blues bleed out.
Yep. I thought that this one, everything felt like it was fixed on, every character is now like fixed to tracks, you know, like Lily even tells Stuart when she's going in after he gives that great, he gives the Shakespeare monologue to.
And which I found out was not Shakespeare. It's Philip right. Larkin.
Yeah. Who says it's Shakespeare? Because, and when they, I guess one thing that he gives the other folks shit about is they don't know culture, and he questions if they can make judgments about how to handle this machine that can move backwards and forwards if they don't understand the importance of humans in history and not just series of events. And the fact that they dismissively say, oh, did Stuart quote that Shakespeare to you? It's like, well, it's not Shakespeare.
Yeah, it threw me off too because it sounded Shakespearean.
It did. But I guess what I was saying about Stuart standing there at that area to get into the dev's facility and Lily coming up, everyone feels like things are now set into motion that can't be changed. They all were supposed to collide at that point, which they start out saying, and Lily doesn't want to believe, but here she is. And I'm with you. It almost seems like her going there, you know, she has the gun, right? Doesn't she have a gun with her?
That's right. She picked up the gun.
It matters less that she's holding that gun and more that she's going. You know, like her presence is as much a danger maybe to that machine as the gun is.
Also, her conversation with Stuart when he lets her in, his line reading there was so stiff. It was almost as if maybe he had a peek at this as well.
Yeah. And I've read things. This is the first week that I really allowed myself to fall into like forum chatter. But people saying that there could be multiple levels of simulation. You know, that's been like the joke for years. Like, oh, well, we're living in a simulation. Ha ha, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Things get increasingly strange. It sounds less ridiculous, maybe. But they wonder if, they describe it almost like, remember Inception, that they have to be pulled out of different dreams at different times and blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. If there's some surface level, like OG Lily is going to do something that causes all of these other worlds to crash and create that moment that they can't see past.
That's kind of really hard to wrap my head around.
Yeah. It would end the simulation that they're in, but that would mean that surface level Lily accomplished her goal.
Interesting.
I don't know.
Well, we're going to find out.
You can get as weird as you want to with this show. Yeah.
You can. I think, so far, it's been great, and I don't see why it wouldn't be. But we'll see more. I think it releases on Thursday. So
yeah, the finale. Can't wait.
And I wouldn't blame anyone if they used that machine just to watch CT carry bananas over and over and over.
Fortunately, we are on machines right now that can allow us to do that. And you know what? I'm going to do it. I've been doing it.
Well, we're going to talk very, very briefly about the challenge, and here's why we're going to go brief, because starting this week, there will be an article up on the Alabama Take from head writer T.D. Wood, one of the originators of the Alabama Take. So he's going to post an article each week, and Adam and I are going to jump in and share some quick thoughts. And he's going to eventually get around, T.D. that is going to eventually get around to doing some power rankings for the challenge. So what did you think about this week's episode of the challenge?
I thought after a so-so premiere episode, I thought this was an incredible episode of the challenge. I thought that the daily challenge, you know, you were texting me saying they're really having to carry these things over a mile, right? I was, it was like a mile back and forth.
I was overwhelmed by this. Dude, I was worn out watching them.
So this is when it really, that first episode where they're pulling the trunks or whatever they were pulling, that was okay. You know, it had a tank. That was nice. But this new one where they're actually doing something pretty physically impressive gives you a taste maybe of what the show has become more. Saw somebody, was a TD, that said it's kind of a combination of like a Tough Mudder style race or like an Xterra adventure, which makes total sense. I mean, if they, some of them probably ran 6, 7, 8 miles carrying these things.
I mean, how?
Well, and then they get to get in a helicopter and drop these boxes that make smoke clouds explode and try to hit a target. It was great. I mean,
that was good.
You kind of wish that you could be in the helicopter flinging these boxes out. You're impressed by the fact that they ran that far. And then there was an absolute masterclass in politicking that led to a great payoff, and nobody really got hurt at the end of it. You know, I like episode where there's a lot of drama, but people I don't care about are the ones who get kicked off the show.
Absolutely. They did the old, it was almost like the psychological play on Jen, where they told her what to say, but deep down they knew what they were feeding her was going to get her kicked off or into the elimination anyway.
Yeah, absolutely. And you sometimes want to shake these people who are rookies and say, like, did you bother to watch the show? I just like download a season off Amazon before you came on to realize that these are not the guys to trust. But thank God she didn't, because it was super great television. I mean, her starting with that "Hello, Earthlings."
Oh Jesus!
just showed like the cringe that went around the room. That's why you watch this program.
That was bone deep cringe right there.
Yeah, it was fantastic.
And it cost her. She ends up getting put. This is Jen. She ends up getting put in elimination. Of course, no surprise there. And I to contrast this, I didn't even break a sweat watching the elimination. I kept thinking to myself, "Oh my God, I could do this one."
Yeah, it was one that maybe the speed with which you could do it would have been competition amongst equals. And I don't think it was necessarily an easy thing to do to flip those things over, but unfortunately she ran into just a buzzsaw in the elimination, which I think the politicking to try to get into the elimination reveals who's going to play this game well. The only other season that I can think of that kind of did this was The Island, which is like a 12-year-old season where you had to have a key, one of 8 keys, to unlock this thing to get on a boat to go to an island off the shore of the spot that they had been living. And the only way to get a key is to win an elimination. And then as all the keys have been dispersed, you could win an elimination and then steal someone else's key. But the point was, it took some politicking to get into competition, and you had to go through that. So I think, you know, Tori, all these people are smart to try to go early, and the people trying to avoid it, you know, that's loser talk. You got to get in there and get it early. I mean, against Jen, that's nothing.
It really wasn't nothing for Jenny, right? Jenny was the one who defeated.
Yeah.
Yeah. So good deal. That's our bit of challenge recap. The challenge on MTV. We will.
There's still time, people. Jump in.
Oh, yeah. Plenty of time. And on Thursday afternoon, I think, is when you'll see our weekly recap discussion on the website. That'll be on the website only, thealabamatake.com. I don't have another, again, lacking on segues. I did want to touch on the Netflix show, I Am Not Okay With This. Did you get a chance to take in any of that one?
We're 3 episodes in.
Yeah, I think that's about where I am, 3 or 4. I'm enamored with the show. Are you down with it?
I am. I thought it was really good. I keep thinking about The End of the Fucking World. That's maybe the closest thing that I can compare it to. And I don't know that it's quite on that level, but it's real good.
But you can't help but compare it to that show, right?
Yeah, I mean, that immediate comparison, and even in unfair ways, like I was thinking that, you know, the actress that's playing Sid is not quite up to the standards of the two actors in End of the World, but that's no knock on her. Who knows what's to come?
I'm going to push up against that and say I think she's better.
Really?
Yeah, I do. I think that she is much more expressive than granted, they were playing very stilted characters on the end of the fucking world. And it's, you know, that was part of it. But I think that she is very expressive. I think she says things with her looks or by the way she contorts her face that can be read ironically if you know what we know as viewers. And I think that's just, I don't know. She's just an easy watch. She is an actress. Is. And she's from, I think she was in It, right? Yeah, I think she was a big star in that rendition of the book. It. I think that this show gets some details right about what it's wanting to say about socioeconomic things. And I know that's a weird thing to say about a kind of a flippant or fun show, but like that car that Stanley drives, she has this neighbor who's really into her, and the house that Sid, our protagonist, lives in. You know, I think this show is supposed to be set in a 2016 kind of era, maybe. I get that feeling, but not everyone is driving cars that were made in 2016. You know what I mean?
Right. Right.
And she's not really living in a house.
Yeah. The house is pretty crappy. Single mom working at the diner. It's not there's nothing glamorous about teenage life in this show.
The house looks like it came straight out of, you know, 1972, but the year's probably, you know, 2016. And that's the way life is for a lot of people.
Yeah, absolutely. She seems to have to take on maybe more responsibility and emotional responsibility. They kind of open with she's still working through her father's suicide that happened in the basement of their home. There's just a lot to unpack with her, I guess. And maybe not even the top of the list is the fact that her anger seems to be able to trigger physical things, like cracking the wall or making stuff fly off shelves or giving a guy a nosebleed. Where are they going with this?
Yeah, I may be one episode ahead of you, I honestly think, because I think I might have a little bit of an answer to that, which I won't talk about on mic. But what a great show. And I think it garners so many comparisons to The End of the Fucking World is because the same guy wrote it.
It's based on a graphic novel, right?
Mm-hmm. And so The End of the Fucking World is based on a graphic novel by the same guy as well, I think.
Well, even the mood of, you know, it always looks like it's about to rain. It's kind of dreary in this Pennsylvania town. They're not like playing baseball on a sunny day here. You know, they're barely affording groceries and getting in, you know, she's trying to stick up for her brother from bullies and that kind of stuff. Going to weird parties.
Yes. And then on top of that, they get a lot of the details right. But I think they do. There's some occasional glimpses of brilliant visual storytelling. You've seen the scene, I think, with the party where Stanley is left alone on the couch.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And it's just that emptiness beside him on the couch is so telling. And another of the excellent things, which I expressed to you when I think I sold you on watching it, the first episode's 19 minutes.
We watched three episodes in one sitting, ate dinner and then sat there with a dirty dish for the next episode, went and watched the last episode. It was great. So we,
it is
we,
that kind of shit
on now. What was your favorite thing about that party? I feel like it's written in the notes.
About the party?
Yeah. There's one scene in particular that I thought was just fantastic. 10 out of 10.
Oh, okay. Did I not? Okay. Tell me.
The pizza, man.
Oh,
they were chowing down on some za, and it looked delicious.
This is so true, because when I was a kid and went to parties, I guess somewhat similar to this, they never had pizza.
Yeah, who's ordering the pizza here?
Because that's where you start getting into some money.
Yeah, you're throwing, you got pizza for that many people? That's an expense.
Exactly. It was a great choice, I think. It felt pretty real, I suppose. This guy was known for his birthday parties, so that's why.
It was a hell of a party.
Mm-hmm. I like that.
Football player giving the speech.
What's his name?
No, he's the worst.
Josh. Yeah, this is a pretty good show. It's a pretty good show. It's very easy to digest. So
yeah, when they sit there watching the football game and Stanley's describing it as like a Shakespearean tragedy, I was like, this is the basis for like 90% of indie rock songs.
Absolutely, yeah. And I think they won me. If they didn't win me over in that first episode, I think they did in episode two where they have a wonderful needle drop of Roger Miller. You remember that moment in the convenience store?
Yeah, it was great.
All right. Well, I'm gonna really recommend this one to our listeners. 19, 20, 21 minute episodes, and there's only 7 total. You can't beat this.
It's a breeze.
It's a breeze. I pair it with Unorthodox.
kind of like a little chaser.
Exactly. After, a palate cleanser.
Yeah. Two very different coming of age stories.
Absolutely. That's right. Well, folks, that's what we've got for you this week on Taking It Down. Thank you for listening. Some of you are wonderful about letting us know that you have listened. We appreciate that. So next time, we will get around to some other shows. And what I think we're going to do, since we're going weekly, is that once we figure out what we're going to be talking about, we'll let you know online. So follow us on Twitter or Facebook. That's probably where we'll post that. We'll let you know what we're going to be covering in case you haven't watched it and you don't want to be spoiled, or you want to kind of play along, so to speak. So anyway, thanks everyone for joining us. We'll talk to you guys next time around.